I'm Carol Coletta, and this is Smart City. Resilience is a quality that is greatly underrated in successful cities. Our guests today are making their own special contributions to understanding how to make cities resilient. Sadu Johnston is leading what may be the nation's best-known municipal green program. He is the commissioner of the City of Chicago Department of Environment, where he manages a whole host of programs intended to restore and protect Chicago's natural resources. Also with us is Brett Parson, winner of the Harvard Innovations in Government Award, about his success in breaking the barriers between the police and the gay community in Washington, D.C. That's today on Smart City, but first, the news. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. Sadu Johnston is the commissioner of the City of Chicago Department of Environment. He was appointed to the post by Mayor Richard Daley in July 2005 after serving as the assistant to the mayor for green initiatives. At DOE, he manages programs to protect and restore Chicago's natural resources, reduce waste, clean up brownfields, promote energy efficiency and reliability, educate the public about environmental issues, and enforce the city's environmental protection laws. Prior to working for the City of Chicago, Sadu served as the executive director of the Cleveland Green Building Coalition. Sadu, Chicago was an early leader on green issues. How did the interest in this issue develop?
From what I can tell, the interest really has been driven by the mayor largely. Mayor Daley came into office about 17 years ago and recognized that Chicago really had a gritty reputation across the world and that people weren't comfortable on the streets, that it wasn't kind of just a friendly place to be on, out in the public spaces. And one of the issues, I think, that he saw that could help to be resolved, or rather he saw that the green elements that he had seen in other cities that he liked could be added to Chicago. And so he immediately went and met with the Bureau of Forestry and asked how many trees we planted a year. And he was told that we remove more trees every year than we plant. And I think he recognized that that was problematic for the city, that people liked to be shopping on streets that had mature trees, that people liked to live on streets that had nice tree canopy. And so immediately he asked them to start planting more trees. And I think that, to me, that's kind of where the green technology started, was really at the basic elements of adding more trees to the city. Since then, he's been responsible for adding more than 400,000 trees to the city of Chicago, both through our own plantings, but through the park district and the schools, and also passing a landscape ordinance, which mandates that the private sector do that. And so for many years, that was really the kind of the main greening element, was just making the streets more comfortable. And that kind of evolved with the addition of the planted medians that you see on the streets. And there's the famous ones along Michigan Avenue, but they're all over the city. And really, that was kind of the evolution of the trees, with the recognition that you're not going to want to shop on a street, you know, if it's five lanes of busy traffic and you don't feel comfortable crossing the street and people are whizzing by. So he wanted to add some planted medians, and kind of like the trees, he didn't get a lot of response from the public or from his own staff. People were very resistant, and bringing up issues like snow and safety and visibility and all sorts of other reasons why we couldn't build these beautiful planted medians, and he kind of pushed along and did one anyway. Now we have over 75 miles of these planted medians in the streets. And so that, again, was kind of another recognition, another lesson for the city leadership below the mayor, that these elements really have improvements in quality of life. And I think the next step to that really was the green roof on City Hall, where the mayor recognized, wait, we're greening our streets and that's working so well, and we're absorbing stormwater and cleaning the air and making things more beautiful. Well, we can do the same on our rooftops.
It's interesting that Chicago started with trees and planted medians and green roofs. As you say, they deliver multiple benefits, but perhaps most important, they deliver benefits that people can see and feel. Some of the environmental strategies that you must be evolving into don't have that same benefit of beautification, so that instant gratification that a tree or a planted median gives you. How do you get City Hall excited about that, and how do you get the citizens of Chicago excited about that?
Carol, that's a great question, and one that we have struggled with for a while. As you say, many of the green strategies that we utilize are very visible. Solar panels, for instance. Those are kind of the green roofs. Those are things that people can see, the media can look at and point at, and people can understand it. It's harder to bring to life some of the more subtle green strategies that have equally important impacts. For instance, for us, we're building every new building that we build as a city to be a green building. And sometimes it doesn't look any different than a regular building we'll build. But it has higher indoor air quality, and it has great natural light, and it saves us energy, so we're saving taxpayer dollars. And those are all really tangible, important benefits, but many people can't see them. The media can't see them. And so we really face the challenge of really integrating the visible with the invisible and clearly communicating the importance of both.
You mentioned green buildings and the city of Chicago's commitment to green buildings. I know that some will say there is a higher first cost on a green building, but over time the operating costs are much lower. How do you manage through getting a group of people who have always done things one way to invest more in the first cost of building a green building to gain the advantages and the operating efficiencies over time?
Another great question. I think at first you really will benefit from leadership at the top, the CEO, the city's mayor, the manager of a building. That basically you need someone at the top that recognizes that this is important, because the first few times that you do something, there's resistance from throughout the organization generally. So the first couple of green buildings we did, there was generally resistance. I mean, people hadn't done it, the architects hadn't done it, the budget was new, and so there was a higher cost at first. And then as we did more of them and we grew experience, there was kind of people got more comfortable with them within the organization, and so it's easier to mainstream it. But at the very beginning, the leadership from the top was critical in pushing it forward. And then once we're kind of in the flow and people have done a few of them and understand the benefits and realize that there's not that much additional cost, it's easier to do. So that commitment from the top was critical, and the mayor's ongoing insistence that we continue to really try new things and be pioneering and innovative in these strategies is really what continues to drive the innovation that you're seeing across the city. So that's the first thing I would say. I think the second thing is really recognizing that we as a city are going to own and operate the infrastructure for the life of that piece of equipment or that building or that street. And so we need to try to think a little bit longer term and invest a little bit more at the beginning at times for the longer term savings. And so I think when those of us that are within the organization that feel passionate about it and are working toward it need to be able to articulate the benefits over a longer period of time to say, okay, we're saving 25% of our energy on this building because we put a little bit more up front, and here's how that's going to play out over 5 years, over 10 years. But I think what we just to stay on the building subject, we don't really think about it oftentimes, but the cost of building a building is really only 10% of the overall cost of owning and operating a building over its life. And we put the money in the capital in the construction, and then for the next 50, 60, 100 years, we're going to be operating that building. And that initial cost, the 10%, really influences how much we spend in the long term. So if we can spend a little bit more up front to make it a better product, we're going to save in the long term. So it's kind of, I think, a combination of strong leadership, really gearing up people within the organization to learn how to do it effectively, and then making the longer term financial argument.
You said the mayor really led the interest in Chicago in green issues. How did you get involved?
I got involved, well, firstly, this has been something that I've been interested in for quite a while. I studied environmental studies and focused on buildings and came out of school and focused on it in my career. So it's kind of been a strong interest of mine for a long time. I got involved with the mayor when I was working in Cleveland, Ohio. I had renovated a beautiful old bank there and turned it into a green technology center for nonprofit environmental organizations. And the mayor came and toured it, and I showed him kind of various green technology pieces of the building, and he liked it, and I guess was impressed with me enough that I got a call asking me to come work with him here in Chicago.
And you didn't begin as the commissioner of the Department of Environment for the city of Chicago. You began where?
I first came to the mayor's office, and I worked as assistant to the mayor for green initiatives. And so part of what he asked me to do when I first started is to really make sure that we're leading by example in all of our operations as a city. And so he and I worked together, convened a group of commissioners, about 16 commissioners, and we focused on creating an environmental action agenda for those departments and for those operations. And so we really looked at how we're going to drill down sustainability into all of our operations. And that environmental action agenda has kind of been a guiding document for the city around some of the goals and strategies that we're hoping to achieve.
And tell me about the environmental action agenda. What kinds of things are included?
Well, what we did is we really broke it into about 16 areas that we were going to focus on. We had subcommittees out of this larger green initiative steering committee, and those areas were everything from water to organic and local agriculture to airport operations to landscaping operations to buildings to incentives for the private sector. So we kind of looked at a range of topical areas and set forth strategies in each of them.
You mentioned business incentives are part of the environmental action agenda. I know that Mayor Daley is reluctant to impose too many restrictions on business. How do you balance his support for business with the need to clean up the environment?
Well, we really try not to regulate so much as to create programs and incentives. And really, the mantra that I keep in the back of my mind is that we really have to lead by example, and that's the mayor's charge to us. We can't expect the private sector to do something that we're not doing ourselves. And so we have experience then in trying out a strategy, a technology, a procedure. Once we demonstrate that it works, we then create policies and programs and ordinances in certain cases to ensure that the private sector follows suit. So generally, we try to focus on the incentives and create policies and programs that will really encourage the business community to go green, for instance. So green roofs are a great example of that, where we experimented with the green roofs and found that they worked really well. They brought the temperature down considerably. I mean, the temperature on a green roof is about 100 and, oh no, on a black roof in the summer is about 160 or 170 degrees. Mm. On a green roof, it's about 90 degrees. And so there's a temperature swing of about 60 or 70 degrees, which makes it easier to air condition inside. So we try it, we demonstrate that it works, we communicate that message, and then we create policies and programs to get them out to the private sector. So on the green roof case, we then created a density bonus. So anyone building in the downtown got a density bonus. They could build extra square footage if they were building a green roof. We then, once we'd done a number of those, we then created incentives within our economic development program through the Department of Planning and Development, where we basically said, if we're giving you money to build in the city as a developer, we want you to meet our environmental criteria. So again, instead of mandating it across the board, we look where we have leverage points and create programs to encourage the private sector to do that. And then we'll create other incentive programs through our own procedures, so we don't just use the money that we have leverage over. We actually will use procedural programs. So we created then a green permit program through the Department of Construction and Permits, where now a developer gets an expedited building permit if they're building a green building. So now there's a financial benefit and a time benefit to developers building green buildings, because they'll get a building permit in 30 days or less instead of the 70, 80, 90, 100 days that they would normally have. So they get skipped to the front of the line, they have a dedicated reviewer who reviews their project, and then we waive some of the fees as well. And so that's an example of kind of how we can tweak our own process to encourage businesses to consider going green. And so what we're doing really is giving them a carrot rather than a stick.
Even with a passionate leader at the top, which you say is important, and clearly it is, it can't be easy to move new ideas through a bureaucracy. Where do you find the most resistance? What makes it tough being inside government advocating for green strategies?
I would guess that the challenges we face within the city government would be the same that one would face in a business environment or even in a nonprofit environment, which is just inertia. People are used to doing business the way they do it. They're used to buying the same kind of paint that they've always bought or the same carpet that they've always bought. They're used to charging the same amount for a city sticker. I mean, we get into our ruts. And I think that's probably the biggest hurdle is really, you know, the commissioner of a department can get the charge from the mayor to do something, but it's often hard to get those in on the ground to change the way that they do the daily business of the city. And so we create policies and programs, and then we just really need to make sure we drill it down into the operations of the department. But my sense is that the biggest challenge is just getting people to be open to thinking about doing things differently. It's one thing for the mayor to say, do a green roof, because he can see it being done. But it's harder for him to say, I don't want volatile organic compounds, VOCs, emitted from the paint that we use. We want healthy indoor environments for all of our workers and people that visit our buildings. It's harder for him to make sure that kind of paint is bought every time we do a project. And so we can create a policy, and we can then start creating procurement guidelines. But it's kind of harder to drill some of those things down. You really need engagement from within the business entity.
Have you seen that take place? Have you seen people who were initially resistors begin to adopt these principles and get excited about the larger implications of adopting these principles?
Yes, definitely. In numerous cases where oftentimes what you'll find is that there's a lack of knowledge around how to do something or what's expected. The mayor will say, go green. But they won't know what that means. They won't know how to do it. There's just, you know, that may not be there. That isn't their area of expertise or their focus. And so with handholding and kind of general partnership, you'll see that different people will really take the lead and will innovate, and that they'll get inspired and will really run with it. And that's happened in numerous departments. I've seen folks really get excited about it and come back with new ideas, because ultimately, you know, they are the ones that know their business. We here at the department don't, and the mayor oftentimes doesn't know the day-to-day operations within a department, and so he'll ask them to integrate these strategies, but really needs to rely on them to do it appropriately. And when they get excited about it, you start seeing some pretty exciting things happen.
We both know the mayor, the former mayor of Curitiba, Jaime Lerner. He's an advocate for co-responsibility government, inviting citizens into the job of providing public services. And he's put that theory to work specifically on recycling. How do you approach the job of motivating citizens to do their part on the environment?
That is one of the, as we as a city have kind of been leading by example, that is now one of the questions that we're really starting to ask ourselves is how do we engage homeowners and even business owners in really utilizing these strategies within their own homes and businesses. And so we don't have the answer to that. I think there's a few things. One, we're trying to create convenience. It needs to be really easy for homeowners and business owners to take those steps. So making the recycling program very easy and clear to understand is one thing. So creating programs and that make it convenient is really important. So we just created a household hazardous waste facility, for instance, because we don't want people to throw oil down the sewers. Well, we need to give them an alternative. So we create a household hazardous waste facility where people can bring their household chemicals and drop them off, and we'll recycle them for them. And then we do neighborhood events where we come and collect it from them. So we don't just tell them, hey, don't throw your oil down the drain or into the sewer on the side of the street. Dispose of it in an environmentally friendly way. Well, here's the way to do it. And so really giving them the tools is the first thing, and making those tools easy to access. The second, I think, is creating programs for engagement. The mayor last year on Earth Day launched a new program called the Chicago Conservation Corps, where we train volunteers to be environmental leaders across the city. And they apply, and then they those that are accepted go through a training course of 6 half-day sessions where they're trained on how to be an environmental leader. They're trained project management. They're trained on different environmental issues in the city. And then they're given a project, or they get to choose a project that they implement across the city, and we partner with nonprofit organizations that are already doing projects that they're interested in. We give them a stipend and we give them mentorship as they implement their project across the city. And as you know, this has been since April, so we've had enough people go through the course now that we're already seeing these projects popping up all over the city. And so there's, in one part of the city, people are distributing thousands of compact fluorescent light bulbs to neighbors. In another part of the city, they're building rain gardens to capture rainwater and educate people about the importance of rainwater. And so we're really trying to, through the program, drill down to get those people that are passionate and care about these issues to get the tools they need to make an impact. And hopefully that'll be contagious and more people will want to do it. We're also now taking that program, the Chicago Conservation Corps, and creating conservation clubs in the schools where teachers apply and get a stipend and then get tools to do an energy audit or a water audit or a waste audit in their schools as they create these after-school clubs with the kids, and then they do a neighborhood project. And we give them the equipment and the curriculum and to give the teachers a stipend to do it. And now the kids are engaged in these issues and thinking about these issues and are implementing projects in their neighborhood and hopefully taking it home. So those are two of the ways that we're trying to really drill this into the public. And this, I guess the last way is just clearly communicating what we're trying to do and ways that people can do it. I think my sense is that people get overwhelmed. They don't know where to start. And they, mm-hmm. You hear about climate change. You hear about deforestation. And it feels so overwhelming. You don't really know what to do or how to do it. And so we're trying to just clearly communicate, hey, here's 5 things that we want you to try. Try riding your bike or walking into work instead of driving, or try taking public transportation. Try saving energy by changing your light bulbs. Just really simple things that people can do to get into the mode of changing their behavior.
It's interesting you mention walking or biking. Jaime Lerner also advocates living closer to work and using public transit. Do you consider those actions part of Chicago's environmental strategy?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. And I think, again, a lot of people think you have to have solar panels on your house in order to be green, or you have to drive a hybrid car. But, really, most of the strategies that we talk about are very, very simple. And people ask me, what's the one thing I can do to be environmentally friendly? You know, it's just, if I'm only going to do one thing, what would you tell me to do? I would say, take public transit. Get out of your car. That's the biggest thing. And so I think we are blessed in Chicago to have such a good public transportation system, and the mayor is committed to continuing to improve it. But when you look at a map of the region and you look at the climate impact per capita of the region, you'll find that we are a lot lower in our climate impact in Chicago than in the suburbs around, because you can walk to the store, you can take the train to work, you can bike to work. I mean, I bike 12 miles to and from work every day. And that gives me, I feel healthier, so you know, I'm getting exercise and I'm more energetic, but I'm also not driving a car, which is improving air quality. So yeah, I think those are very, very important parts of creating a green city.
What is the next environmental frontier for cities?
I think the concepts that Mayor Daley's pioneering here in Chicago really, to me, are the next frontier. And it is designing and operating the city to really work in harmony with nature rather than against it. So, for instance, stormwater. We have traditionally seen stormwater as a major nuisance, and we've spent billions of dollars capturing stormwater, pumping it, and then treating it. Instead, what we're trying to do is to look at stormwater as a resource. So we capture the stormwater on our green roofs or on our parking lots and put it into cisterns and then use it for practical purposes. Put it into rain barrels so homeowners can use it to irrigate their backyards. So really looking at stormwater as a resource instead of as a nuisance saves us money, because we're not paying the electricity to pump all of that water. We're not paying for the chemicals to treat all that water. Instead, we're using it, which is also saving water that we don't need to pull out of the lake. So I think that's an example, and it's often called ecological design, that strategy of designing to use nature or to work with nature instead of against it. And I think we can do that in virtually every aspect of our work as owners and operators of cities. So one example of that is a tunnel that we're just finishing construction right now, where we're capturing all the rainwater from our convention center, and it's one of the largest in the country, 55 acres of roof surface there, and we are capturing it instead of putting into the storm sewer system, where we need to build big concrete pipes that take all that water from a smaller pipe to a bigger pipe to a big pipe where it's mixed with industrial waste and sewage and then treated. We're pumping it directly into Lake Michigan. So we're recharging the lake 55 million gallons worth a year. And so we're recharging the lake with that water and not having to pay to treat it and manage that water. So we can do the same with daylight. We can capture daylight and use it to light our buildings, to help heat, cool our buildings. We can use the sunlight to generate energy, the wind to generate energy. So there's all sorts of ways that we can kind of work more effectively with nature, and that's, I think, to me, the cutting-edge future of green technology.
And Sadhu, would you say that is a guiding principle, not just for the Department of Environment, but for the City of Chicago as decisions are made in departments throughout the city?
That's one of our goals, and that's one of the charges that we have from the mayor is to really make sure that is a guiding principle. It is starting to be that way. I don't think we're fully there yet. I think there are a lot of departments and commissioners that are thinking more and more about this, but there's still more work to be done to really make that a kind of a guiding principle for all of our decisions.
Sadhu, thanks for talking with us on Smart City.
Thank you, Carol. Nice talking to you.
Sadhu Johnston is Commissioner of the City of Chicago Department of Environment. After a short break, we'll talk to Brett Parson, winner of the Harvard Innovations in Government Award, about his success in breaking the barriers between the police and the gay community in Washington, D.C. Smart City is made possible by the generous support of Memphis Urban Innovators, a collaboration of Memphis business leaders, including the Memphis Tourism Foundation, who are focused on bringing smart people, smart ideas, and smart solutions to Memphis and the new economy. You're listening to Smart City. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. Otis White runs Civic Strategies in Atlanta, and each week he brings us urban insights from around the country. Otis, we thought the era of mega deals was over, but you found a new one for us.
Yeah, Carol, this is from Seattle, and it is a deal that, you know, would astonish Wall Street if it were to happen among corporations. Here's what, and it's Byzantine, and it's complicated, and it's not what it seems to be, which makes it, of course, a wonderful story. This is what it looks like. In Seattle, King County, which is the county that surrounds Seattle, seems to be willing to trade its general aviation airport for some railroad right-of-way so it can build a bike and pedestrian trail. Now, so we get this straight. We got an airport. We're willing to trade it for the right-of-way for an old train line that's not so used anymore, so we can create this recreational asset. It's about 47 miles of railroad tracks, so it's not small. The port of Seattle will end up getting the airport, but of course it doesn't really own the railroad, so it's got to trade something to the railroad. So it's going to buy the railroad tracks from the railroad, give it to the county, and then get the airport in. So it's a three-way deal. Okay, we'll buy, we'll trade, we'll get, and everybody will have sort of swapped assets in the end. But here's the interesting thing: there are a couple of little side deals that are involved in this. The port is willing to throw some money into it for the county, so that it can actually convert the railroad tracks to this pedestrian recreational asset. In return, it wants a little island near the port that the county was going to build some landfill on. Okay, so the newspapers are all focused on this big deal, railroads for airport to port. The real key to this is that little island, which is called Harbor Island, near the port. The reason is, and this is why the railroads are so interested in dealing the railroad tracks, the port wants to create a gigantic intermodal yard so they can take stuff right off of ships, put it right on a train, and head it over the Cascades, and in that way become far more competitive with Los Angeles and San Francisco and Oakland and other ports up and down the Pacific Coast. So the whole thing about the rail, the airport and the rail is sort of beside the point. The point is to do something that will dramatically bolster the building of this new intermodal yard. The state of Washington is willing to invest $25 million into making the deal work and improving the rail connections out of Seattle so that the port can thrive. So there's all these gigantic forces at work. But the key to it is like the detail in the deal, and it is a fascinating deal. You almost never see anything like this again. It is going to restructure the way that these governments operate.
And the people get a pedestrian bike connection in the mix.
Yeah, up and down the east side of the county, you'll be able to ride for 47 miles on what is basically very narrow, but interesting parkland. These bike trails are very popular these days, and of course Seattle is made up of young folks who like to get out on their bikes and see the countryside. So it's for the county, it's not a bad deal. They get rid of a general aviation airport that really wasn't very profitable, even in the good years, and they can deliver a new service to the people.
Interesting. Otis, we'll talk to you next week.
Thanks, Carol.
Otis White is a regular columnist with Governing Magazine.
You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. Steve Goldsmith is former mayor of Indianapolis, who now directs the Innovations in American Government program at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government.
Community policing obviously is a collaboration between the police and the community. The object is to identify a problem and then to solve that problem. And whether or not to create a special unit is always a management question for a police department. I was a DA for 12 years, and sometimes we'd have specialized drug units, and sometimes they'd be decentralized out to the precincts, as the case may be. Washington, D.C. won an Innovations Award from Harvard's Kennedy School for its Gay and Lesbian Liaison Unit, and it seems to have gotten this kind of mix right. There were not enough reports made of crimes that were occurring to the police department and from the gay and lesbian community. There's too much distrust. There's too much suspicion. So crimes would go not only unreported, they'd go unsolved. The creation of this unit was a really interesting idea in that it not only was outreach to the gay and lesbian community, it was responsible for solving crimes. And as a result of that, more of those crimes got reported. The closure rate for all crimes, particularly homicide, went way up. The relationships between the department and the community got better. And hopefully over time, obviously, crime will go down as well. It's a really good example, I think, of how to get one of these specialized units correct. And we recommend to people they take a look at the Washington, D.C. Gay and Lesbian Unit.
Brett Parson heads the D.C. Police Gay and Lesbian Liaison Unit. Brett, what was the rationale for creating a Gay and Lesbian Liaison Unit in the D.C. Police Department?
Well, to say that there was one rationale would probably be inaccurate. I think there were probably several different motives behind it. I mean, let's face it, we're in Washington, D.C., your nation's capital, home of politics, and politics certainly played a role in that. But I think probably the more benevolent reason and the reason that probably sold more people was specifically looking at services to marginalized communities. And when you specifically look at the gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgender community, and I'm going to use the word gay from now on, they really were reflecting a poor service to that community. Specifically, when we looked at hate bias crimes, we looked at hate bias crimes reported in 1998 to the FBI, and we looked at the surrounding jurisdictions of Maryland and Virginia, compared them to D.C., and what we found was just a dramatic difference in reporting, to the point that Maryland and Virginia reported in the hundreds, and D.C. reported a total number of hate crimes in 1998 of a grand total of two. And it didn't take a rocket scientist to figure out there was some sort of a problem there. And specifically looking at the gay community, what we figured out was, let's try and do a better job of liaisoning with this community, building a bridge of communication, and also do a better job of training our police officers what this community is all about and what it is they need.
What has the unit been able to do that the rest of the police department could not do?
Well, if you look at hard statistics, one of the amazing statistics out there is that on average, the chances of a police department closing a violent crime in the United States is anywhere from about 55 to 65%, which doesn't sound great, but that's actually the average nationwide. Our police department hovers just below that average normally with regard to violent crimes. When this unit, the Gay and Lesbian Liaison Unit, gets involved in an investigation, either as the lead investigators or more often than not in supporting role as a supporting role in the investigation, we have over an 85% closure rate. That in and of itself is an incredible statistic. Then you look at just the awards we're winning from community groups. You look at the anecdotal information that we're hearing from community members about how comfortable and safe they're feeling. And that all adds up to a huge difference in service to this community.
What makes the difference between the close rate of 55 to 65% and your rate of 85%?
You know, I would love to take credit for incredible detective work or state-of-the-art policing. But what this really is, Carol, is getting back to basics, getting back to basic community policing that most police officers really cringe when they hear that term community policing, because it's traditionally this huggy-feely, sing kumbaya type of policing style that really doesn't net you much law enforcement. What we've done is we've taken that strong bond with the community of getting out there into the community and welded it together with actual law enforcement. And that's been the secret here of not just going out and putting our arms around community members and saying, hey, it's great to see you, how wonderful, you're gay or lesbian or bisexual, and joining the community, but then also being the ones to respond to those crime scenes, the being the ones to investigate incidents of domestic violence in the community, being the ones to investigate incidents of distribution or use of illicit drugs in the community. that's really been the launching pad, because it serves two purposes. It serves us in gaining credibility within the community, because we're no longer considered a pushover or some fluffy PR unit. But we also gain a tremendous amount of credibility within the law enforcement community, because our peers look at us and say, wow, they're actually doing police work. We actually benefit from this type of work.
Well, I was going to ask you how the rest of the police department reacted to the unit's creation. What was the initial reaction before you began to produce results?
Well, I have to say, first of all, that Washington, D.C., I think, is a bit of a different duck with regard to most jurisdictions. We are an extremely liberal jurisdiction, and I think our police department generally reflects that in the people that make up our police department. That does not mean we didn't have people from the very beginning who thought this was the wrong thing to do, that creating special policing for special groups is the wrong way to go. I'm sure those people still exist, but I think by and large, the overwhelming majority of police officers, whether they're with the Metropolitan Police Department or surrounding jurisdictions or the federal agencies we work with, I think they are all relieved to know that the unit like this exists, because we take a tremendous amount of pressure off of them, that we come in and deal with cases that oftentimes they are either uncomfortable dealing with or just inequipped to deal with, because they don't deal with this community on a day-to-day basis like we do.
Is it staffed only by officers who are gay and lesbian?
Absolutely not, and I think it would be a mistake to do something like that. You know, when you're putting together a program like this that is serving a marginalized community, one of the things you want to do is you want to serve as an example for the outside. And the example to be set here is that you don't just need gay people to police in the gay community, that there are hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of police officers who are straight but not narrow, who are allies to this community. And I think having members of the allied community part of the Gay and Lesbian Liaison Unit has also been a huge credibility boost for us, because people look at us from the outside and say, you know what, it's not just gay cops that are working with the gay community, but straight cops are also, and they are being embraced by the community.
Are there other equivalent units in the D.C. Police Department that are dealing with other marginalized communities?
We do have other liaison units. We have a deaf and hard of hearing liaison unit. We have a Latino liaison unit. We have an Asian liaison unit. The unique factor for us, and that is what we were awarded for by Harvard Innovations in American Government, is that we take and we join those missions of not just the outreach, which is what those other units are doing, but we also do the law enforcement side of it. And that's what makes us unique, not only in our police department, but around the country.
Women, of course, were once fearful of reporting rape and domestic abuse, and some still are.
Absolutely.
Are there police problems or crime problems that are particular to gays and lesbians?
Well, I don't think you could say particular to gays and lesbians. I think crime, victims of crime run every gamut that you can think within demographics. Are there particular crimes within the gay community that appear to be more prevalent? I think you could probably safely say that within all categories, whether it's murder, robbery, even hate bias crimes, we are probably seeing a victimization at the same rate of gays and straights. The difficult thing is how do you measure that? How do you measure an invisible statistic? Because the majority of those people who are being victimized who are gay are not identifying themselves as gay.
Sure.
And it's not a box that you necessarily, first of all, are allowed to check, but is it appropriate to even ask that question if the victimization had nothing to do with their sexual orientation?
Right.
The one thing I will say, though, Carol, is that we've seen a tremendous upswing, particularly here in Washington, D.C., but I would say in most urban environments where there are large, visible gay communities, in the crystal meth epidemic. And I think it is hitting the gay community, particularly gay men, extremely hard right now. And if you talk to many people in the public health arena around this country who are researchers and also practitioners in public health, I think they would tell you that the use and abuse of crystal meth right now is reaching epidemic proportions within the gay male community, and because of that, there's some serious public health issues. Does that mean it's a criminal justice issue? Well, of course, it's an illegal drug, so yes, that's, you know, it starts with us to enforce those laws.
You bring up actually an interesting question I hadn't thought of. How do you get involved? Since as you say, it is unless sexual orientation is somehow involved in the crime or central to the crime. How do you know that, or how does the rest of the police department know to get your unit involved?
Well, if you remember, in Batman and Robin, the Batlight would come on and it would swoop the landscape of the city. The same thing happens in D.C. We have this pink searchlight that sort of goes back and forth, and that's how we know we should jump in the GLO U-mobile and go out there. In all seriousness, Carol, part of that is training. It's part of the three parts of our mission. One is outreach, the second is law enforcement, and the third is training and education. And it's training police officers and community members what the GLOU does and also what the indicators are to indicate that the gay community is involved in this type of a case. And so where we never really taught police officers what the signs and symbols of this community were, we now train our police officers what a rainbow flag means. We train police officers what particular tattoos or particular magnets or particular nonprofit organizations, how they link up to the gay community to indicate to an officer, this may in fact involve a member of the community and I should probably contact the GLOU, not because the person's gay, but because there's a potential. And then we can come in and sensitively and professionally and respectfully find out if in fact our services are needed.
Now, if the news is correct, Washington has had a crime spike recently. Is that true?
Well, I think our chief of police has been very public about that. Our chief was took it seriously enough that he declared a crime emergency during the summer months, and it was only very recently that we dropped down to our normal level of policing. We were very concerned about some of the specifically spikes in violent crime here.
And why do you think did the police department ever form an opinion about why that was happening?
Boy, I think you could have 1,000 researchers get together and come up with reasons. I don't know that there's one reason you can give, whether it's the economy, whether it's social reasons, whether it's the way the moons are aligning or the way the tides are going. There are many reasons why crime ebbs and flows, and I don't know that the police department really is in the business of questioning why. It's our job to be proactive, to realize that it's happening and find ways to stop those trends.
Again, you raise an interesting question because you say it's not your job to figure out why it's happening, and yet to be proactive in some ways you need to understand the sources of crime so that you can get ahead of them. It puts the police department, of course, in a very difficult position, like school teachers in a lot of ways. I mean, you're dealing with all the ills of society. How do you begin to look at patterns and decide how to be, if you will, proactive?
Well, first of all, you realize that the police department does not exist in a vacuum, that crime is simply the end result of many, many other issues going on in your society. And our chief of police, Charles Ramsey, has done an incredible job over his years being the chief of police here of building bridges with other agencies and realizing that, the Metropolitan Police Department, our role, quite honestly, is to try and prevent crime. When crime occurs, react to it very quickly and to bring people to justice. But all the things that cause crime to occur, those things are normally social issues. Those things are issues that are outside the realm of control of the police department. But we certainly can be communicating with the agencies that control those resources and working hand in hand with them to get those resources to communities where we see problems emerging. And so I think that's probably your best bet is, much like the GLOU does, is creating kind of a coalition of communities together to fight problems.
Brett, to you and the members of the Gay and Lesbian Liaison Unit of the Washington, D.C. Police Department, congratulations on winning the Harvard Innovations in American Government Award.
Thanks, Carol. I appreciate the opportunity. And please let all your listeners know that, with this award comes money for us to come to other jurisdictions and try and help them start units of this kind, and we are happy to do that.
Great. Thanks, Brett.
You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. One man's junk may be another man's treasure, but City View's commentator Walker Smith explains that recycling goes beyond the cans and bottles you take to the curb each week.
A friend of mine is a found artist. He creates sculptures, mobiles, and collages from whatever materials he can find and recycle from trash bins and refuse piles. Once a week, he patrols the sidewalks of Lower Manhattan, searching through the cast-off flotsam and jetsam people no longer want. Now, admittedly, picking through the trash is a big price to pay for one's art, But he's okay with it because what he fashions from these found objects are highly sought-after museum pieces that reclaim and salvage the value of the materials used to create them. The late Georgia preacher, Howard Finster, was the first outsider artist to break through to mainstream recognition. One of his principal works was a 3-acre environmental museum park he called Paradise Gardens. It was decorated with colored shards of glass, bottle caps, costume jewelry, milkshake blenders, old engines, candy boxes, party horns, dashboard figures, freezer racks, a copper toilet bowl cock, and even his son's tonsils displayed in a glass jar. The value of litter and trash is not limited to art. Archaeologists have long made a study of the midden heaps of ancient civilizations, or their trash piles. Archaeology has even made its way to modern landfills. In 1973, Dr. William Rathje launched the Garbage Project at the University of Arizona, spawning a new archaeological specialty known as garbology. Over the years, Garbage Project garbologists have studied 150 tons of trash and excavated 21 landfills. They have found insights into technology, diet, nutrition, recycling, hazardous waste, and refuse decomposition. When we collect shells at the beach, or go antiquing, or sort through secondhand stuff at a yard sale or thrift shop, we too are looking for hidden value in the cast-off objects of others. What's fresh and new is not always the most beautiful or the most informative or even the most fun. A few years ago, a popular morning radio team in Atlanta had a running gag about furnishing an imaginary house entirely from discarded things found on the interstate highways that run through the city. Every day during drive time, people would call in to report the items they had spotted in the road, and the radio host would gleefully check those items off their master list. It took less than a year to fill up their imaginary house. All it takes to turn a sow's ear into a silk purse is some imagination and a little dash of daring and chutzpah. But oftentimes, this is very hard for communities and city planners to do. It's a dilemma they face frequently, whether to preserve and revitalize their heritage or erect the future over it. Yet this is a false choice. For oftentimes, a community's best future rests on a platform rooted in renewing and rejuvenating the past. The problem is that we live in such a throwaway culture that it can be hard for the past to get its due. There is no easy answer, of course, but there is a place to look for fresh inspiration and ideas. And that's no further away than the found objects that others remake into the new art we pay a considerable premium to own. For City Views, this is Walker Smith.
Walker Smith is president of Yankelovich. He comes to us from Georgia Public Radio in Atlanta. Join us online at smartcityradio.com to listen to archive shows, sign up for podcasts, and register for our weekly newsletter. National distribution of Smart City is made possible by the Hyde Family Foundations, investing in programs that generate lasting change to improve the future of Memphis, Tennessee and its citizens. For more information, visit HydeFoundations.org. Eric Rudd is our co-producer and engineer. I'm Carol Coletta.